Welcome back to another episode of City Hall Pass. I'm Kapel Lungani, counsel to the mayor of New York City. We created this forum, the first of its kind in New York City, to give you, the public, a unique window into the highest levels of our city government. We interview New York City's finest public servants and get them to open up in a way that is both deeply personal and insightful. And on its best days, we hope that our podcast is equal parts educational and inspiring. And now I want to introduce my two co-hosts today, two brilliant women who inspire me every day, Bess Chu and Kate Coughlin.
Thanks, Kapel. Happy to be here. This is Bess Chu. I'm currently Chief of Staff to the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor.
Hi, I'm Kate Coughlin, and I currently serve as Deputy Counsel for the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor.
Our guest today is the President and CEO of the New York City Health and Hospitals Corporation, Dr. Mitch Katz. As many of you know, New York City Health and Hospitals Corporation, otherwise known as H&H, is the country's largest municipal health system, with 11 acute care hospitals, 5 skilled nursing facilities, dozens of community health centers, a home care agency, and even an insurance plan. Not only does Dr. Katz oversee this entire healthcare ecosystem, he also makes time to see his own patients. During his tenure at H&H, Dr. Katz has transformed the public healthcare system in New York City by expanding access to primary care services, reducing administrative costs, investing in more frontline clinical staff, and stabilizing H&H's overall finances. Before returning home to New York City, Dr. Katz served as the director of the Los Angeles County Department of Health Services and served as the director and health officer of the San Francisco Department of Health for 13 years. He's a graduate of Yale College and Harvard Medical School. In this episode, Dr. Katz takes us behind the scenes at H&H during the COVID pandemic to discuss his employees' heroic work and talks about his lifelong commitment to public service. We hope you enjoy. Gives me great pleasure to welcome the head of New York City's Health and Hospitals, Dr. Mitchell Katz, to City Hall Pass. Dr. Katz, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for the invitation.
Dr. Katz is really well known. He appears often alongside the mayor, has been a central part of the city's response to the pandemic. I want to start, Dr. Katz, with a very basic question. I think a lot of people understand what the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene do, but I think we should start by giving our listeners an insight into the specific role that H&H plays here in New York City. It's the largest public health care system in the United States. And as CEO of the largest public health system in the United States, what is it that you do on a day-to-day basis, Dr. Katz?
Well, we run the 11 public hospitals. We run 70 other outpatient sites. We provide all of the health care that is received by inmates who are at Rikers. We have a home health agency to take care of people who are not able to leave their homes and need that care, especially close to their home. In those services, what's most important to me is always mission. There are other wonderful health systems in New York City, great private systems. What I always want to focus on are the people who get left out, the immigrants, the uninsured, people struggling in poverty, the black and brown populations, people who are not getting the care they need. And I want them to get care at our facilities and know that they are always welcome and that it doesn't matter to us whether they can pay their bill or not. It doesn't matter to us where they're from. We're here to take care of them.
How much of that commitment to the vulnerable came from your upbringing?
Well, I hope a lot. I grew up in Sheepshead Bay, Brooklyn. The Coney Island Hospital, one of the H&H hospitals, was our family hospital. My great-great-grandmother was in Coney Island Hospital with a broken hip. And the treatment at that time was sandbags. Because they couldn't do surgery, they would immobilize the person with a sandbag. And I always wondered, do you think that sand came from Coney Island Beach? I don't know. But, you know, it shows how deep the use of health and hospital facilities. They were poor. They went to a city hospital for their care. I grew up with two wonderful older siblings, both of whom are developmentally disabled. And it made a very major impression on me. I realized at some point that I had been blessed with certain intellectual abilities that they did not have. And I wanted to make the most of it. I wanted to be able to use whatever skill I was lucky enough to get in some way that would be useful to other people.
You left New York for some time to go out to the West Coast. What brought you back to New York? And what does it mean to you to be the head of Health and Hospitals and to be here serving your hometown today?
It's a wonderful feeling, and it is a complex story, like many people's life stories. When I went out to train in San Francisco, I never expected that I would spend most of my adult life in California. In fact, one of my first thoughts was, this is ridiculous. There's no winter. But I got great residency training and fellowship in San Francisco, and I grew up in that system. I came here from Los Angeles, where I was very happy, and I was doing good things and running the second largest public hospital system with four public hospitals. Public hospitals are what I do. I have never worked in any other setting because I won't work for any hospital that does not treat all patients equally at all levels. So I made a decision very early in my career, I will only work for public hospital systems. So there I am, I'm in Los Angeles, I'm quite happy, but I have very elderly parents. And my parents are now 98 and almost 94. And I wanted to be able to take care of them and help them. And so when the job opened, I was, oh my God, here is an opportunity where I can stay taking care of patients in public hospitals and I can take care of my parents. That's an unusual intersection in life. What was amazing was just coming back, because the truth is I hadn't lived here since I was 17. And all of a sudden, like, I'm bicycling and looking at the Brooklyn Bridge, and I'm bicycling over the Manhattan Bridge. And it was just like an amazing thing. And all the landmarks that were the same, like the UN and the Empire State Building. And then all the things that were completely different, like the sections of Brooklyn that I grew up in, which look very different from when I grew up in them, because it's 40 years, right? So there is, and I know the mayor talks about this all the time, there is an excitement of New York that I have never lived any place where you feel that. And there is a way that you walk on the sidewalk, right? You walk down this sidewalk and there is every kind of person, right? Every kind of person ethnically, every kind of person economically, right? We're all stuffed into the subway, the homeless, the executives, because it's the quickest way to get anywhere, right? I love that. That feeling was so special upon coming back.
Did you always want to be a doctor?
I didn't always want to be a doctor, but I always wanted to be useful. I love taking care of people, and in that sense, being a primary care doctor has fit me. But my real focus is the idea that we all have an obligation to use whatever skills God has given us to help others, and that that's the way to live a happy and meaningful life.
You've hired hundreds, if not thousands, of doctors in your position, Dr. Katz. You've led the two largest municipal public health entities in the entire country. Taking aside intellect, if you had a couple of characteristics that you always look for in doctors, it certainly sounds like humility is one of them. But what are the defining characteristics of a great doctor?
Well, it's funny. I think it's the same characteristic of a great administrator. Maya Angelou said, people do not remember what you said. They remember how you made them feel. I think that's incredibly true. What people need is to feel healed. What people want to feel is that you, as a doctor, have done everything you possibly can to give them a shot at health. What I found is that what you want to do in any clinical encounter is make sure that the person knows you care about them. If they feel that you care about them, they will be healed by the interaction. No doctor knows everything. I don't know everything. But if they know that I'm doing my best, I think they will benefit from the encounter. And so, you know, I think that's why, you know, I put humility high up in the list, because you have to have humility in order to realize the limits of your ability, the willingness to ask someone else. And I think that's true for all of us who do administration. One of the things that gives me confidence when I work as the president of Health and Hospitals, especially in a time of COVID, I don't know everything. There's no reason to assume that if there's a problem, I'm going to have the best answer. On the other hand, I could be really resourceful. and I could measure myself by how resourceful I am, right? So maybe I don't know the answer, but can I find the person who does know the answer? And so to me, the first question when faced with a difficult problem that I haven't faced before is, okay, well, who do I think is the most knowledgeable, experienced person on this issue? And let me call them, right? Because why should I assume that I would know the answer, right? I'll find the person who is smartest about this, or maybe no one knows the answer. And so I'll invite 15 members of my own staff who I greatly trust. And I'll say, look, it's a really hard problem. Let's have an open discussion about what our potential solutions are. And I think that if you always know that the right answer is to ask others who know more than you do, you'll come to the right answer. And I think that's as true of medical care as it is on how to administrate.
You've spoken a lot about what makes a good doctor. I, as a member of the public, how do I find these good doctors?
Well, you know, I think the most important thing is that everyone has to find a primary care doctor that really they reverberate with, that they feel hears them and understands them. It always has to be someone that you feel good about. And while I do think that if you are open as a doctor, the number of people who will feel good about you is greater. You're not one kind of doctor. So I think it's about finding that person who you feel comfortable with.
Dr. Katz, you still treat patients, correct?
Yes, every week.
Why is that important to you?
Well, first, that's my identity. I mean, if you woke me up in the middle of the night and said, what are you? I said, I'm a primary care doctor. I'm really an administrator from a secondary point of view. My whole interest in administration came out of being a primary care doctor because I was frustrated with the experiences that my patients would have, that they would be made to wait for hours and hours. And my signature things every place I've gone, I start and I say to the administrators, why do people who come for outpatient appointments have to wait for hours and hours for their appointments? People say, well, that's because we're so busy. I say, no, because you see them by the end of the day. So if the person came at 9 o'clock and you saw them at 2, you could have fixed the problem by giving them a 1:45 appointment. It has nothing to do with how busy you are. It has to do with whether or not you start by assuming the person's time is valuable and that they deserve to be seen when you say you're going to see them. Now, if you don't care about that and you think, oh, they're all poor people, they're not working, they come on the bus anyway, a whole set of patronizing things that I vehemently disagree with, then that's what you're left with, is that everybody comes at 9 o'clock and some people wait 4 or 5 hours and everybody throws up their hands and says, you know, well, we're busy. Well, that's a fixable problem. And I didn't want to be one of those people whining. I didn't want to be one of those people who just gets cynical. Oh, nobody knows how to run a system. What can I do? This is how it is. Apologizing to my patients. So sorry that this has occurred. I wanted to be someone who would change things, but I want to change things from the point of view of a primary care doctor. I don't want to change things from the point of a fiscal person or an administrative person. I feel these are health systems. They are for the patient. And therefore, the right way to run them is the way a primary care doctor would run their practice, which is to the benefit of their patients. So to me, the job of primary care doctor and health and hospital CEO are interchangeable.
We'll be right back with more from our conversation with the president and CEO of the New York City Health and Hospitals Corporation, Dr. Mitch Katz. But I want to take a second to share with our listeners that the city's vaccine reservation site is now easier to use. New Yorkers can visit nyc.gov/vax4nyc. That's nyc.gov/VAX4NYC to make appointments whenever we have the supply. It's available in 10 languages and includes city sites plus other providers. I also want to remind our listeners to get tested for COVID-19. And remember, tests are free and confidential. Text COVID-TEST to 85548 or visit nyc.gov/COVID-TEST to find a convenient site near you. Or you can call the new COVID-19 hotline. Call for free advice from medical staff, quarantine guidance, emergency food, hotel rooms, mental health counseling, travel guidance, and much more. Call 212-COVID-19 from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 7 days a week. Back to you, Capel.
Dr. Katz, as CEO, as you said earlier, you oversee 11 hospitals, and many of these facilities were the hardest hit during COVID, like Elmhurst. How did you approach managing what became an unprecedented crisis in the history of New York City and, frankly, the country?
Well, Capella, it was horrible. I mean, that's the first thing that has to be said. It was horrible. And that there are many people in my system who are traumatized by what happened to them. The reason they're traumatized is that as doctors and nurses, we always seek, and all health professionals, to save life and to be in a situation where all of a sudden, all of these people are coming to you, gasping for breath, dying within hours of coming to the hospital. I mean, this was unprecedented. You know, even as somebody who lived through the worst years of the AIDS epidemic, where during the early years, all of my patients died within 9 months. That was how it was. But this was people dying in minutes, and they were coming at a speed that people had never seen before. I remember the night that they called me at Elmhurst and said, "We've intubated more than 10 people in the last 2 hours." Intubated meaning putting a breathing tube down their throat and putting them on a ventilator. On an average day, even in the busiest trauma center, you might intubate one or two people. Right? That's just how it is. And all of a sudden, being flooded with these people with a disease you've never treated before. We had nurses who had many more patients than they normally take care of, and doctors who had many more patients, and people had to do their best. And people are traumatized by the worry, I didn't do enough. Even though they were amazing heroes, even though they worked 16, 18 hours under tremendous stress. I mean, for anybody, just putting on an N95 mask, something on your head, the heavy gown, and walking into a room is difficult. You're worried, will I get infected? Will I bring this infection home to my children and spouse, my parents? It was such a stressful experience for people. And, you know, they really deserve to be honored. And what I always do is remind people that however hard it was, what they need to take from the experience is that they saved lives.
During the worst days of the pandemic, what was going through your mind? Were you afraid? Were you scared? Were you feeling fear in the same way that many other people in the city were feeling?
I was. What I was feeling was, oh my God, this is the middle of a catastrophic event. I am over 60. I'm male. What happens if I get sick and tomorrow I'm on a ventilator? Right? Who's going to run health and hospitals? And it was the first time that I really had to confront. I mean, it was the sense of, but I couldn't possibly leave health and hospitals unattended. So, you know, I did feel that sense. I mean, the best moments, and it won't surprise you, were the successes. Someone made a video of an African-American woman over 90 leaving Metropolitan fairly early on after her hospitalization. She's waving, you know, and people are applauding her. You know, she made it. It was such a stressful experience for people. And, you know, they really deserve to be honored. And what I always do is remind people that however hard it was, what they need to take from the experience is that they saved lives. And we didn't collapse. None of the health and hospitals collapsed. In Wuhan, the hospital system collapsed. In Italy, the hospital system collapsed. In New York, the hospital system did not collapse. And the public system, which does have an older infrastructure, we did not collapse. We even took patients from other hospital systems that were not able to manage their patients. What I did is to try at every way I could to facilitate the work. And all of a sudden, I mean, just to give your listeners a sense, on March 1, we had zero intubated COVID patients. On April 13th, we had 960 intubated COVID patients. We tripled the size of the ICU in 6 weeks. If you said to me, how long, Mitch, do you think it would take under normal circumstances to triple your ICU capacity? I'd say, well, if you got all the approvals and this was your number one focus, in 2 to 3 years, you could get it done. But I was on the phone every night with my hardworking administrators. It's 11 o'clock, it's midnight. And I'm like, okay, what ward are you opening up tomorrow? Okay, what are our choices? And I felt that, again, my job was to tell people, make the decisions that are best for our patients. That's the only way we're going to get through this.
So early in the pandemic, our team worked really closely with your team and Dr. Ted Long to stand up the Test and Trace Corps. And it was done very well and to ensure everyone was protected and everyone's information and privacy were protected. And we also worked to ensure that when someone had to quarantine, there were incentives. We would pick up your groceries, do your laundry. This required creative thinking, right? But also required really fast thinking because all of this was happening, as you know well, everything was changing every day. How did H&H, with the help of the Department of Health and City Hall, create such an effective and robust operation?
Well, I am very proud of Test and Trace. What I felt was that this was a huge operational function. We were incorporating the intellectual abilities, the hard work of DOH, MH. Many of their leaders were heavily involved in the creation of T2. We were just the operational arm. I think that that operation was certainly responsible for why we did not have the peak in cases that were seen in other parts in the country in the second wave. So while we had a second wave, it never had the quality that we saw it in other places, despite the fact that New York City is the densest of all possible areas, right? So it's so much harder for us to contain a virus for which space helps you because we're all crammed together, right? We all live in vertical structures and we take elevators. It's just a very different life. We created several hotels with your help that enabled us to have people isolate themselves. We deliver medications and we did it all keeping people's information always confidential. And I think that was a great achievement.
Dr. Katz, you've spoken quite a bit to us about the importance of the public hospital system and the importance of primary care. People are still suffering lingering and long-term effects after the infection. And I know that you have opened a couple of centers of excellence focusing on caring for those individuals. How important is it to have that longer-term care? And what is it that these centers are doing for individuals?
Sure. Well, it's very important to have the centers because there are a large number of people who got over the initial symptoms of COVID, but are still suffering a variety of lung problems, neurologic problems, fatigue, mental illness, stomach issues. And so having centers where we have the right diagnostic ability and where we have doctors and nurses and pharmacists who can really focus on what their symptoms are. I do think that the primary care approach, we're used to dealing with people who have lingering symptoms, whether that's from a cancer that was successfully treated or someone with heart or kidney disease who has a set of symptoms, right? We may not always have cures, but we have symptomatic treatments. We have hope. One of the things that I've always told people who are trapped in an illness is, okay, but can you think about what life might be like in 2 months, right? And being able to move someone into that space, I think, can be incredibly helpful.
You've talked about your experience in San Francisco, LA, growing up in Brooklyn. How has that affected your ability to advise the mayor on what are extremely difficult, time-sensitive issues and on issues that I'm sure really weren't discussed in medical school? I often talk to my own staff about the legal issues that we confront. And as you said, Dr. Katz, we were confronting an unprecedented crisis. They don't teach you in law school how to emergency lawyer. That's just not something that's taught. When you're in the midst of a crisis like that, creativity, guts, risk management, the ability to inspire people, your staff and other people who frankly are all confronting these uncertainties and understanding that we have to make decisions because 8.6 million people are depending on us to make decisions is a critical part of your job. Can you talk a little bit about how your life experience aided you as you advised the mayor of New York City during this crisis?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. Neither law school nor medical school nor any kind of school would prepare you for COVID. I mean, if COVID teaches anything, it teaches humility, right? It teaches you to know that you don't really know everything. And I do think it helps to be over 60, right? I mean, experience is collective. People who are young can be as smart or smarter, but they may have 30 years of experience. If you've got 60 years of experience, you have a sense of a greater part of life's passage. coming from a family that dealt with, you know, it's hard, I know, for people to even imagine, right, what it's like to raise, for my parents, developmentally disabled children in the 1950s. People would say that the kid was dropped on the head. That was the common, right, because nobody wanted to accept the responsibility that they had produced a developmentally disabled child. I think coming out, right, I mean, at the time, the world has moved in so many positive ways. But, you know, I came out at a time when the medical profession said that it was perverse to be gay, right? I mean, I came out at a time when the doctors that I knew who were gay were all in the closet, right? And, you know, there was a completely different sense about it. You know, I worked in San Francisco during a time so many people died. AIDS taught me a lot about the importance of non-medical care. When you say medical school is about the diagnosis and treatment of disease, it's not about healthy lives. It's about the diagnosis and treatment of disease. But life is much more complicated than disease. So, you know, I think being open to life, to seeing its complexity, you know, one of the things that so impressed me about the mayor, and I think is one of the bonds between us, is I was on the phone with him at like midnight and 1 a.m., right? I mean, he was incredibly involved in advocating. And that really moved me, that he was so focused on how do we get the support for the healthcare workers.
So this week, the city announced that it has administered over 3 million doses of vaccine, which is really something special and amazing, especially considering the last year at this time, the city was just starting to shut down. What role has H&H played in supporting the ongoing vaccine distribution?
We're very proud to be a large part of the solution of vaccinating New Yorkers. We're providing vaccine at all of our 11 acute care hospitals, at all of our federally qualified health centers. And then we're running 3 of the large community centers, City Field, initially now Bathgate in the Bronx, Brooklyn Army Terminal in Brooklyn. And I think in the next weeks, we'll be in additional sites to be part of the vaccine success.
And why are mass vaccination sites so important?
You want both kinds. You want to be able to vaccinate your own patients, and especially the Pfizer vaccine, having it in a hospital setting is helpful because the requirements of freezer are so rigorous. But then you also want sites where you can vaccinate people who are, you know, unaffiliated with any medical system and be able to do that as quickly as possible. And so we want to have throughout this both sites. One of the things that pleases me is in my own clinic, when I see a patient and I can walk them down to get a vaccination at Gouverneur, they're already there, they're already registered, no need to go to a website, no need to call anyone. I just walk them down as I would if they were getting a flu vaccine. But then there are other people who are not seeing a doctor and we need them vaccinated. So together, I think the vaccine mass sites and the clinical sites will work well.
Dr. Katz, you've been the head of H&H since 2018. And during this period of time, you've transformed the way that H&H operates and in many ways modernized the public health system. Can you tell us about some of the key reforms and advancements that you've been able to do at H&H?
The ones that I'm proudest of are the ones that helped us survive COVID. So I'll start with having a unified electronic health record. When I came, the efforts were kind of languished. It was in a few places. It wasn't everywhere. It had a very long timetable to be executed. I'm like, no, this is modern stuff. We got to be able to have one system. Everybody has to be on it. It has to be friendly. The system allowed us to take care of people much more efficiently and to exchange information, so that when patients did need to be transferred, we could do it. I added 350 net nurses. I wanted to grow the number of nurses. And so we were able to add a lot of nurses. And then finally, fixing the fiscal system was distinguishing the idea that we do not charge patients. But come on, guys, we got to charge insurance. People sort of blurred that. We don't bill patients. We don't take patients to court for the bills. We do, you know, make the insurance companies pay their fair share. And just replacing that and requiring that insurance companies pay us, that they pay us fair prices, that we document our care such that we get paid appropriately, that erased just 2/3 of the deficit right there. And I think gives us a pathway to go, you know, strongly into the future.
If you could go back to January 2018, well before COVID, when you were first appointed as president and CEO of Health and Hospitals, what advice would you give yourself?
I think that what I now feel more strongly, and when I mentor people about administrative roles, feeling like you have a formula that is uniquely yours and that is adaptable to any situation, I think gives you a sort of confidence. And so, you know, I feel this sort of a Mitch way of doing things, and the people recognize it. Right. It has its own set of characteristics. It always starts by saying, what's the mission? Now, it doesn't start with what's the dollars. It's like always, what is it we're trying to do here? What is the core thing? And so, you know, when I came kind of nervous and I also a little frightened. I mean, New York City government is a complex government, as the three of you know. And although my career was spent in government, New York is a different, very different animal in terms of the sheer complexity. Right here, I have a board that is my governing board. I have a mayor. I have a city council. I have a controller. And people are coming at me. And it was a little bit confusing. How do you make progress? I think I would have said, you know, it's okay. Take your time. Take some deep breaths. Pay attention to what's going on. Form relationships, right? I mean, I think at the end of the day, you get stuff done because people want you to succeed. Therefore, you have to be the kind of person that people would want to succeed. So maybe my advice would have been, it'll be okay. You grew up here. You'll figure it out. People will get to know you. People will accept you. It'll be okay.
All right. So we are introducing a new game. Here are the instructions. I call this game the Cats in the Hat, said the Kate. In this game are two things. I will tell them to you now. You pick thing one or thing two, said the Kate with a bow. Okay. So are you ready to play the Cats in the Hat?
Yes.
Okay. LA or NYC?
NYC.
Bike or subway?
Bike.
Luna Park in Coney Island or Victorian Gardens in Central Park?
Luna Park.
Brooklyn or Manhattan?
Manhattan.
Mitch or Mitchell?
Mitch.
And that concludes the Cats in the Hat.
Dr. Katz, thank you so much for spending time with us today on City Hall Pass. I think you're an extraordinary leader, an even better human being, and we're all better for having known you. And thank you so much, Dr. Katz.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I want to thank our guest today, the president and CEO of the New York City Health and Hospitals Corporation, Dr. Mitch Katz. Dr. Katz's lifelong commitment to only work for hospital systems that provide care to everyone is really all you need to know about who he is as a human being. And I know from having worked closely with Dr. Katz during the COVID crisis, his leadership was critical to the success of our public hospitals and the city's COVID-19 response. We hope you enjoyed this discussion as much as we did and look forward to talking to you soon on another great episode of City Hall Pass.
This podcast is brought to you by the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor of New York City.